who are attending this hearing. Will the students from Boscobel please rise? Thank you. We're delighted you were able to come with us today. You may be seated. For those of you who do not know, the court and the state bar have a joint program called Court with Class, whereby we invite students from all over the state to come and listen to an oral argument. The students have briefs and other materials about the case and may have engaged in various studies about the case. Did you all receive materials in the Boscobel students on this case? Students always deny getting anything. Well, I'm glad you did get the materials. And there is a description of the case we're about to hear out on the table in the foyer. This Court with Class program is a national award-winning program, and we're very proud of it. And I'm especially proud today to say we've won another national award for the court's outreach to the public. The history committee that I established for the 150th anniversary of the Supreme Court, which is this year, the year 2003, prepared an exhibit under the direction of Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and it just won an award from the American Judicature Society, a special award for outreach. So Wisconsin continues in its national award-winning for public outreach, of which we're very proud, and I hope you are too. With that said, and having met you all from Boscobel, let me introduce the court to you. Starting on my far left is Justice Patience Rogensack, our newest justice. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, of whom I spoke favorably before.
at this instant.
Right. Very cautious. That's right. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Diane Sykes. With these preliminary introductions made, I'll call the second case 02-0469, Randy A.J. versus Norman I.J. and Brenda B. Representing Norma I.J. is attorney Robert J. Welsenbach. Have I pronounced your name properly?
That's correct.
Good. Counsel, you have 13 minutes. Ms. Weber, representing Brendan V, has 12 minutes. Mr. Price, you have 30 minutes. And Ms. Weber, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Robert Welsenbach, and I represent the respondent, co-appellant, co-petitioner, Norma I.J. We're here today to decide the fate of Wisconsin law as it relates to husbands, wives, children, and the biological parents of those children. As the court is aware, this case involves a man other than the husband who was ordered by genetic testing and was determined to be the biological parent. However, he was not adjudicated as the father of that child.
Excuse me, Counselor. Was the other male involved, Randy, was he ever tested?
I don't believe that he was.
So we don't know what his percentage would show up as, correct?
We do not.
Thank you.
The Court of Appeals here determined that although the trial court had no authority to dismiss the paternity action once the genetic test came back, the Court of Appeals adopted the equitable parent doctrine and determined that they could use that to name Randy as the father. We submit that the Court of Appeals was incorrect in adopting this doctrine, that they overstepped their bounds, and that this doctrine is not necessary for Wisconsin law as it already provides for the same relief.
Okay.
As previously stated, Brendan B. was determined to a 99% percentage to be the father of the child. The trial court, however, held a best interest hearing and concluded that it was in the best interest of the child to name Randy, the husband, as the father. Both Norma and Brendan appealed to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals did find that the trial court applied the statutes improperly and determined that once the genetic test came back, the court was powerless to dismiss that action under either 767-458 or 767-463. However, as stated before, the Court of Appeals determined that the equitable parent doctrine could be adopted and that could overcome the presumption that Brendan had established by the genetic testing. We believe that the Court of Appeals erred in adopting this doctrine because the same relief is already afforded under Section 767-458 sub 1M.
What's 767-458 sub 1M? What are you referring to? You've got to slow down a little bit.
That provides, in the case where there is a man outside of the marriage who asserts his paternity, that prior to genetic tests being held, the court can hold a best interest hearing. And if the court determines it is not in the best interest of the child to order those tests, the court can dismiss the action and refuse to order genetic testing. That is different than Section 767-463, which states that any time in the proceeding, the court may refuse to order genetic tests and dismiss the action. And I think there's a distinction between those two statutes. I believe that 767-463 really applies to a situation where you have a husband who is trying to get out of paying child support, and at any time in that proceeding, the court could say, no, we're not going to determine your paternity to see if you are the father or not. If you raise the child as yours, and we're going to prevent the test and name the child as a marital child.
What is this action before the court?
Well, it's, I guess, a hybrid of a divorce and a paternity. It initially started as a divorce action, and then Brendan intervened and asserted his paternity, and the tests were done pursuant to that.
Okay, that the tests were done pursuant. I think that maybe there's a difference between paternity actions and divorce actions. And the question of fatherhood within divorce actions.
Well, there's.
Do you agree or disagree, and if so, why?
Well, clearly there's a distinction between a divorce and a paternity, but the statutes also deal with a situation where you have an intact marriage or a marriage that's going through a divorce, and that's why you have the separate statutes. That's why you have 767-463 and why you have 767-458.
Is there? Well, 767-458 is entitled First Appearance. That's the initial appearance. 767-458 is First Appearance. First Appearance in what?
Well, I think normally that would be, I think the intent of that is that it was to apply to paternity actions. However, I think if you look at the legislative history, I think the title of the statute was reinstated by the reviser of statutes to state first appearance, but the statute itself indicates in paragraph 1, at the first court appearance where the respondent is present, the court shall inform the parties of the following, and then there's several things that the court needs to inform the respondent about that the test could obligate him to pay support, etc. So I think it's really dealing with the first instance where you have a gentleman who could be adjudged as a father, and the court is under the obligation to inform him of that.
Let me further try to tease out this distinction to see if one even exists. Action is started as a divorce action. In the course of a divorce action, the wife says, here's a case that happens all the time, or happens on occasion. In the divorce action, custody becomes an issue. The husband wants custody, one child involved, and the wife says, why fight you on custody? You're not the father. So paternity is, fatherhood is introduced in that case. And Mr. X comes in and says, although he's not the husband, he's the father. Is he entitled to an attorney at public expense?
I don't believe so at that point.
Mm-hmm. Is he entitled to a jury trial on that issue within the confines of the divorce action?
Well, I think he would be provided with, I guess, whatever relief and the normal paternity procedures would allow him.
So if it is, if the only thing before the court is a divorce action, but the issue of paternity is raised, it's your position then that even though no paternity action has been started, the paternity procedures are engrafted upon the divorce action?
Yes, because you're still dealing with determining the paternity of that child. I think the court is under the same obligations to inform the respondent of the effect of that, and I think would be entitled to the same relief as if it were paternity. Just because it's under or within that divorce case shouldn't affect his rights or his abilities.
I see conflicting statutes here, and I'll tell you what bothers me. And the conflicting statutes that I have problems with are 767.48. Then when you get to that 1M, that's right above sub 2, that says, if genetic test ordered under this section, or 49.225, show that the alleged biological father is not excluded and that the statistical probability of the alleged father's parentage is 99.0 or higher, the alleged father shall be rebuttably presumed to be the child's parent. And that's the statute we use all the time in the normal paternity action where there's oftentimes some young kid who's denying paternity and then you have blood tests and it shows paternity. That, when there's 99.0%, he's rebuttably presumed to be the child's father. Now that seems to contrast, in my mind, with the whole presumption, section 891.41, where there are different scheme, and that deals specifically with actions involving, a husband who thinks he's the father. And the presumption seems to be at odds with the presumption in the paternity action. And under 891.41, the husband is presumed to be the natural father, but that presumption can be rebutted under sub 2. And the presumption is rebutted. Now you have someone else with the presumption. That's the husband, natural father. The presumption is rebutted if the, for want of a better phrase, interloper, no one should take offense, comes in and tests at 99.0 or higher under sub 2, then apparently that test constitutes, under 891.39, a clear and satisfactory preponderance of evidence that the interloper is the father, even if the husband is unavailable to submit to genetic tests. So it seems to me that there's a different schematic involved, a different procedure and a different playoff on the presumptions between 891.41 together with 891.39, which says then the interloper is, it constitutes clear and satisfactory probant, has met the burden of proof of parenthood, where under the normal run-of-the-mill paternity action, what happens then, the 99.0 doesn't mean that the interloper has met the burden of proof of parenthood. Instead, it just means there's a rebuttable presumption. How do you deal with that tension if you see it? Or explain to me why there's no tension.
Well, I don't think there is any tension. First of all, you're correct that you start under 89141. If the child is born during the marriage, the husband is presumed to be the father. The way to overcome that presumption is to have genetic tests which show a man 99% or higher.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that happens,
That happens under 89139. It constitutes that he's met the burden of evidence in asserting parenthood.
Right.
Okay,
and I think
then what?
Once you establish that, there are other statutes where, I guess, the husband or another man could come in and assert that he wants another test or that that test was somehow flawed or otherwise challenge the test. But unless there is something done to show that that test showing 99% is incorrect, that presumption has to stand. And that man is going to be adjudged the father because there's no other way to overcome that presumption. And that's why we feel the Court of Appeals was wrong to say the equitable parent doctrine can overcome that.
Is constituting a clear and satisfactory preponderance of the evidence the same as constituting a rebuttable presumption to be the child's parent?
Well, I think they're similar. I think one is the rebuttable presumption is just indicating that it is not the be-all and end-all. There are certain ways to overcome that.
What does constituting a clear and satisfactory preponderance of the evidence?
Well, I think that's the standard of evidence that the trial judge must use. And he has to look at if there's another expert report or something like that. He has to compare the reports to the genetic tests, which have already shown that man to be the father, and see if those other reports or that whatever, however they want to attack the test, see if that can overcome the clear and convincing evidence. So I think that's an evidentiary burden.
What is the burden of proof? I thought it was I thought clear and satisfactory preponderance of the evidence constitutes the burden of proof in this case.
Once the man is judged to be 99% to be the father, that is the standard of proof required.
May I ask one question? You represent the mother.
Correct.
Why is the mother so determined that Brendan be adjudicated the father?
Well, staying with the record, I think it was clear that those parties had a relationship. They intended at that time to continue their relationship and that they intended on marrying someday. So that is the reason that she's pursuing it.
Counselor, if I might, I wonder if you have misspoken or one of the briefs is not correct. On page 6 of the brief, it says, the court ordered Norma, Brendan, and Selena to undergo genetic tests. Blood tests showed that Brendan was Selena's father. Is that correct?
That is correct. Thank you.
Ms. Weber?
May it please the Court, Justices, I am Attorney Jennifer Weber representing the biological father, intervening petitioner, Brendan B., in this matter. I think that one of the key points to this is that when you're looking at the statutes, both 767, 458, and 767, 463, it requires that the court can step in upon objection of parties to dismiss an action or dismiss the intervening alleged father from the action based on a best interest hearing. What happened here was that all of the parties in this case, except for my client because we were not a part of the action yet, stipulated that genetic testing was in the child's best interest and it was undertaken because of that stipulation. Randy had requested a best interest hearing prior to any genetic testing being ordered for many months. In fact, I believe close to 12, 13 months into it, he steadfast held his position that he wanted that best interest hearing so those blood tests wouldn't be taken. For an unknown reason, all of the parties, including the child's guardian ad litem, agreed that it would be in the child's best interest to have genetic testing done, and therefore the court issued the order for genetic testing to be done with my client. At that time, then, I believe that under 891, we rebutted the presumption that my client was the child's father. When the genetic testing came back showing him to be 99.99% probability that he was this child's parent, I believe that the only way he would be able to overcome that presumption that he is now satisfied by the evidence is to show the factors as set out in 767-4581E, which was that genetic tests were flawed, a chain of custody was broke, he was sterile or impotent, he did not have intercourse with the mother during that conceptive period, and that another man did have intercourse. The standing to get out of his presumption that he has now gained is to be argued solely by him. He is the person to have the standing to argue that he is, in fact, despite what the tests have shown, not to be the father. However, in this case, he agreed upon the test results coming back that he was, in fact, the father of the child.
Ms. Weber, what's wrong with what the Court of Appeals did here? The Court of Appeals basically applied equitable estoppel, then the equitable parent doctrine, and then looked at the findings made by the trial court in regard to best interests of the child and accepted those findings. What's wrong with that?
I believe that having a best interest hearing was not an appropriate step for the trial court to take, because the best interest hearing was supposed to be had prior to the genetic testing being taken. When you have it afterwards, then this court and the trial courts in family actions are going to have to put men, or even, as we argue, women, up against each other to determine who may actually be a better parent to the child. And that's not what the standard provides here. We conceded that Brendan did not have a statutory or constitutional right to his genetic testing under the case law. But when everybody agreed, they had to live with those results. And what the Court of Appeals did here is that the Court of Appeals went to the next step and said, well, now that we know who the biological father is, we're going to put the two up against each other to determine who is the better parent. And I don't think that's appropriate, because then every parent in this state and in this country could be attacked by another person who may or may not form a, or who may form a parent-like bond with their child.
We've got an amicus brief here from Milwaukee Legal Aid. And Milwaukee Legal Aid says, basically, if you're going to adopt the equitable parent doctrine, add to it a fourth requirement, looking at the best interests of the child. Why shouldn't we do that?
Because if you adopt the language that the Legal Aid Society has proposed, it would essentially require courts to compare people, to compare parenting. And if there's...
Doesn't that go on in every custody case, a comparison of the attributes, the positives and the minuses of each of the proposed custodians?
Absolutely, but it limits the comparison to the child's parents. It does not limit the unfitness standard when a third party wants to come in. The standard then shifts to an unfitness standard as set forth in Barstead, as well as under 767.24. Custody to a third party.
Barstead talks about compelling interests, compelling reasons. Under the circumstances as found by the trial judge here, couldn't there be a reasonable finding that there are compelling reasons to allow Randy to raise this child?
No, because I believe in Barstead. Barstead and the unfitness standard that Barstead has set forth requires that both parents be found to be unfit. You can't just shore in on one side and then declare...
Barstead talks about unfitness or other compelling reasons. It doesn't just talk about unfitness as I read Barstead. So where are you getting that requirement of unfitness?
I'm getting the requirement of unfitness under 767.24, custody to a third party or a relative, which requires a finding that both parents be declared to be unfit. And I believe that in Barstead, an other compelling reason should not be equated with best interests. It is an other compelling reason, and if the court, when deciding Barstead, wanted to say other compelling reason met best interest, it could have put in as a prong in Barstead that it was a best interest. Our argument is that an other compelling reason is, in fact, higher than a best interest, which would require unfitness.
Counselor, isn't the reasoning that you're relying on, though, in Barstead, dependent upon, as a foundational principle, the constitutional rights that a parent has to rear his or her own child? And doesn't Barstead also quote Quillian versus Wolcott from the United States Supreme Court, saying that right is not just dependent on whose blood the child carries, but is dependent on the relationship of the parent to the child, correct?
I would agree with that, yes.
And are you asserting then that your client has had sufficient contacts, that his parental rights rise to the level of requiring constitutional protections as a foundational matter?
I will say that, yes, as far as during the first 15 months of this child's life, he had established a bond equal that to that, or if not more to that, of Randy's bond. They spent, Norma and the child, spent equal time with both Brendan and with Randy. So during the first 15 months, and then we had this chain of events where Norma Johnson went to prison in
But he
in May.
Never asserted to anyone, aside perhaps to Norma, that he was the father. He never provided all of the support that a father would usually provide during that course of time.
I disagree with that, and I believe he did. He purchased all of the baby furniture. He purchased every necessity that that child needed in the first 15 months of her life for when Norma and the child resided with him. Furthermore, he held himself out to everyone other than Randy to be that child's father.
Why didn't he hold himself out to Randy to be the child's father? Is that in the record someplace?
I believe that it is in the transcripts that because Norma was going through a very extensive legal defense, that she had asked Brendan not to comment to Randy about the paternity of Selena, because essentially the parties were in a very precarious financial situation with Norma's legal defense at that point. But immediately upon the termination of Norma's legal defense and her imprisonment, approximately 1 month after she went to prison, Brendan asserted his paternity in an Illinois court, which we found out would be a fatal position. He did not take long after the cutting off of his substantial relationship with his daughter to try to come back in. And then in the divorce proceedings, he was essentially barred from furthering his relationship. So our argument is that, yes, he had a substantial relationship with her, and now the blood tests confirm that. And what I believe that the court has said, that this court has said in re the paternity of CAS, is that to allow a blood test and then later determine at some sort of dispositional hearing that it's in the child's best interest to adjudicate someone other than the biological father affects bastardization of the child and ruptures the existing father-child relationship. And in this case, we now have, and as the courts have traditionally found, to want to protect the traditional family unit. The traditional family unit that we are now in need to protect is Norma, Brendan, and the child. It is not to protect Randy, Norma, and the child, as we know that this case is a divorce case. Whereas the unit to provide, or the area to provide here, is to protect that family unit. And Randy can be protected, and the legislature has given him a statute under 767.245. When someone establishes a parent-like bond, they can get visitation, and they can have reasonable periods of that. And the blood test, what we are asking the court to do, is to essentially complete the ministerial duty of adjudicating Brendan to be the father in this case. It is simply to confirm the blood tests that have shown him to be the father. Furthermore,
I'll just ask you a question about that. On Appendix 14 in your brief, appears the Court of Appeals decision. And my understanding is from this that there was an estoppel at the trial court level and in the Court of Appeals to argue that Brendan is the father, right?
No, well, I would disagree.
All right. But then what it says is, we affirm the trial court's determination that it was in the child's best interest that the court stop Norma from asserting the child's parentage. We hold that Randy is the legal father. We also hold that Randy is entitled to custody. So, under this, your argument is that Brendan's parental rights have been terminated because the blood tests definitively show he's the father.
Would you like me to continue? My time has...
Yes.
The first disagreement that I had was that Brendan was not found to be estopped from asserting his...
Well, Norma was found to be estopped.
Correct. And there was no cross-appeal taken, so, and there, that is not before the court, so I will stand here saying that Brendan is not equitably estopped from asserting his paternity. Then I would further say that because he has rebutted the presumption, that what follows after he rebuts the presumption, and there is no evidence other than an equitable parent, which I don't believe is authorized under statute or law to rebut Brendan's presumption that he is now the father, that the court had to essentially take the next step and grant the rights of paternity. It's our...
I think this is contrary to the evidence. There's no evidence in the record to show that Randy is the legal father, or is the biological father, I should say.
Correct. I believe that because of the test results came back that Brendan was a 99.9% probability as the father. There is no evidence, and I believe in the record there was a concession by Randy that Brendan was the biological father.
All right. So legal father is different than biological father. How do you determine a legal – what does legal father mean?
That's something that I've wrestled with throughout the case, that we have consistently put adjectives before what a father is. Our position is a father is first and foremost a biological father
or
an adoptive father. I do not believe that any case you can come in and step up to parent-like status or two-parent status absent those two findings.
So once you get rid of legal father, if you're correct, then the issue is who should have physical placement.
Correct. And I believe that the record showed at the trial court level that both Norma and Brendan were willing to provide Randy with reasonable visitation under 767-245.
Well, is Randy willing to give a visitation to Brendan? Or didn't that come up? And if there's holding that Randy is a legal father, does he ever have to give visitation to Brendan?
That would assume that the trial court would find Brendan to have a parent-like relationship, and then Brendan would come in under the same statute that I referred to, but it would be an awkward situation because Norma and Brendan continue to be in a relationship with each other for the child to essentially have placement with Norma and Brendan and then have to explain to this child that Brendan is actually her biological father and stepfather.
So visitation hasn't been decided?
No. I believe that the trial court in its decision or as part of the trial transcript had indicated that it couldn't share custody with three people. The statutes didn't allow that, and we essentially were stopped there.
Well, are we talking about legal custody or placement custody?
Legal custody and physical placement.
Well, no custody, legal and physical, for three people. That's what he said.
I believe that is what the trial court said during questioning when we had questioned both Randy, Brendan, and Norma about their willingness to promote a relationship. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Price, representing Randy A.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. My name is Matthew Price, and I represent Randy A.J., the legal father of the child. To accept the petitioner's arguments, I believe, with all due respect, would be to be complicit to the assault on the single most important determination made by family law trial courts each and every day in this state, and that is consideration of what's in the children's best interest. Why is there this assault today on the best interest standard? And the answer is very simple. It's because when reviewing the record, as the trial court did extensively and the Court of Appeals, so much so that they decided to adopt the findings made by the trial court, the record is replete with information, evidence, and testimony that it is in the best interest of this child that Randy be the legal father for all purposes. Court of Appeals made it clear that Randy is the only father that this child has ever known. And Dr. Crandall's testimony at trial in response to questions by the guardian ad litem indicated that to the minor child, Randy is the minor child's daddy, was the exact words used in that line of questioning. I believe the issues raised with regard to equitable estoppel and equitable parenting can apply and should apply, but I also submit to this court that it is unnecessary to reach that decision today if it chooses not to take that tack.
Why?
Because I believe that under 767-463, the trial court properly exercises discretion in dismissing the matter even after the blood tests and the genetic tests were taken. The Court of Appeals disagreed with that reason, but nevertheless affirmed the result reached by the trial court. So I do have dispute with the rationale applied by the Court of Appeals as it relates to 463.
Now, opposing counsel indicated that on the record, of course, there was this bonding that took place between Brendan and the child for at least the first 15 months that he lived intermittently. In fact, she said equally between the Randy and Brendan, Norma living with Brendan at that time. Is that why wouldn't that cause some thought as far as, now the, we know what the trial court did in the Court of Appeals, but as far as his relationship with the child?
Well, I would submit that if we were to support the nefarious relationship and the sort of, for lack of a better term, conspiracy of what happened between Brendan and Norma to essentially subject the child to a person without the knowledge of the father, the husband, in the marital relationship would be to support that kind of behavior. And I think that there was clearly, and we're not disputing that during that 15-month period of time, as Norma was continuing to proclaim that she was a model for Saks Fifth Avenue down in Chicago, that she would spend extended weekends down there taking the child with her. Obviously, had Randy had any clue whatsoever that this behavior was going on, I think it's safe to say that he would have proceeded with some action. But to continue with this relationship and knowing both parties, both Norma and Brendan, discussing extensively the fact that they had reason to believe that Brendan was the biological father of this child, but yet keep it from Randy, I think is a very important factor in the best interest determination.
Mr. Price, you a minute or two ago were telling us that you would rely on 767.463.
Correct.
That's the approach that you'd urge us to take.
That's correct.
How do you get around the language in that section that talks about may, with respect to a man, refuse to order genetic tests if genetic tests have not been taken? Okay. How do you get around that language? The Court of Appeals couldn't get around it.
Right. I understand they couldn't. I believe there's several aspects of that statute that require review in terms of the reading of the plain language. The one that you bring up, the may and the and, I believe the statute, by using the word and, indicates a conjunctive, a list of options that the court can exercise. And the word may appears in there, which indicates that the court has a discretion to exercise either of those options, one being refuse genetic tests and two to dismiss the action. I would point out, if we look at how the statute is constructed, that it gives the action first and then the condition following. So in other words, the first part says refuse to order genetic tests if genetic tests have not been taken. That's the first option that the trial court can exercise. And then it says and, which means another option, dismiss the action. Well, the only condition precedent, but which actually follows that action, is for the court to make a best interest determination. If it was read any other way, that would require that the best interest determination would be moot because genetic testing would exclusively control dismissal, which I think is contrary to the balance of the statute, the at any time language, the fact that this statute 463 was instituted 10 years after 458-1M was instituted, which indicates the intent of the legislature to introduce a general best interest statute, which was frankly missing from the statutes for a long period of time. And I think also that it would make no sense for this legislature to introduce a statute that would give narrower powers than an existing statute. I think we have to recognize that when the legislature acts, we have to assume that they do so with the knowledge of the statutes that exist already. And 458 is a very narrow statute, and to enact 463, if one would argue that 458 is as broad or broader than 463, would render 463 moot. Why even have it? Clearly, the legislature intended to broaden the powers of the circuit court to make that best interest determination at any time.
You agree that that this action is not a pure divorce action, that it's really sort of a hybrid divorce paternity action?
Absolutely. I mean, it's clear that these unusual circumstances, it started as a divorce, and then the paternity issue became a part of the action. And I suppose you could argue that a separate and distinct action could have been taken, a paternity action could have been brought. On the outside, that wasn't done, and I'm just assuming that was more of a streamlining process to get to the point that the court did in analyzing the paternity aspect of Brendan's interaction in the case.
So you see nothing wrong with utilizing the provisions in regard to paternity as well as the provisions in regard to a divorce action and the presumption in regard to paternity during a marriage?
I don't, because I think that you will you'll get to the same place anyways, because you're going to have the competing divorce interest on one hand and the paternity interest, which on the other hand will have to be meshed to ultimately result in the best interest determination by the court. I think the Court of Appeals did have it spot on when it found that the presumption under 89141 was overcome, but then the further reading to sort of synthesize the two statutes is that 767-48-1M provides yet another layer of rebuttable presumption to determine what's in the child's best interest. And that, I think, is the right and the only reading of that statute, because if you strip the trial court of making that determination, you have essentially machines on the bench that can't care for the children, which this court has held over and over and been resolute and firm about, is that the best interest determination is the paramount consideration.
But Mr. Price, 767.463 begins with the clause, except as provided in 767-458-1M. I assume that applies to both alternatives?
I believe it does apply to both alternatives.
Well, 1M says, in an action to establish paternity where a child is born while the mother is married, that the party can allege no best interest. But the second sentence is, then you don't order genetic tests. It seems to be some kind of disconnect.
I would agree that the statute probably isn't worded the best it could be to be read with the rational way that the trial court did, but I don't think it's would be unfounded to indicate that 458-1M deals with the first appearance, and I think the added language of first appearance is critical to the reading of 458, which is why we concede that 458 does not apply. But I think that the fact that except is provided in 767-458-1M language does not at all limit the authority of the trial court to act if at any time during the proceedings they find it's in the child's best interest.
That second sentence, I think it's the second sentence in 1M, the one that says, if the court or a circuit or a supplemental commissioner determines that a judicial determination of whether a man other than the husband is the father is not in the best interest of the child, no genetic test may be ordered and the action shall be dismissed. That sentence, I don't think, can be read to refer exclusively to an initial appearance, because I think it's nigh on impossible to contemplate that a circuit court judge at the initial appearance is going to have all the information necessary to make a judicial determination of whether or not it's in the best interest of the child. I think that language, to me, contemplates something other than the 5 or 10 minute first and initial appearance in a paternity action. Do you agree or disagree?
I think that the intent of the first appearance language, I think the way that the paragraphs are written, the subsection that you read, it still gives the court the authority, may or may not. And it seemed to me that the circuit court is not put in a position where it has to decide at the first appearance necessarily to order or refuse genetic tests, which is indicative of the language in 463 that gives the court the option to do it again.
Yeah, I'm referring and focusing not on the may be ordered, but whether or not a judge at initial appearance can make a judicial determination of whether a man other than the husband is the father is in the best interest of the child. That's what I'm referring to. To me, that kind of determination is outside the scope of an initial appearance at a paternity action.
I would agree that under most circumstances, the court at that time does not have all the information necessary to make that determination.
And if you look at subsections 1, 2, and 3, they all begin at the first court appearance. If you look at M, which was obviously put in after 458 was adopted, it doesn't start that way. It starts in an action. And then my question to you is that under paternity, as I read these statutes, you can raise paternity either in an action or by motion.
Correct.
And I gather here it was by motion.
It was. What happened was
there was no separate action. Then the statutes are inconsistent. Sometimes they talk about action and they don't talk about motion, but one would assume that that's included since you can do it by motion.
That would be my agreement, because that's how Brennan was involved, was by motion to intervene significantly after the action was started.
Now, do you think that as a result of this decision, Randy is now, under the law, the father of the child? Ian has all the rights and responsibilities there, too, and Brandon is cut out?
I would agree with the first half, that I believe that Randy is the legal father of this child for all purposes.
He's the father under the law.
Period, and has all the rights
and responsibilities
that any father would have. As far as Brendan's concerned, I don't think we have to take this to the level of equating it to a TPR proceeding. I think that there's the opportunity under the third-party visitation statutes that if there is legitimate concerns and the best interest determination is made by the court, that I think there is the authority for the court, if it feels it's appropriate, for Brennan to have a role in the life of this child. But we're a long way from that based upon the facts and the record.
Well, you got to my second question before I did, namely, isn't this really a TPR? In effect, they terminated parental rights after scientific evidence shows he is the father.
I think it terminates his right to act as a parent under the divorce-like custody and placement statutes in terms of exercising that responsibility. I don't think, though, it forecloses him from coming in as an interested third party and having an impact.
I could say that under termination of parental rights, too. Person's parental rights are terminated. They then, after termination, they get their act together. They turn out to be a model citizen, and they recognize that they can no longer be the parent, but that there is a bond that may have developed, and that now they want visitation rights or legal placement or whatever as third persons. Don't you think they could get it?
I think they can. I mean, I think
so,
that...
in that sense, Brendan is no different than a parent whose rights have been terminated.
Well, I would though assert that I don't think that the unfitness standards required in TPR questions, in TPR cases, to successfully end that relationship need to be found in this case to reach the result under the statutes that they
do
exist.
Do it under estoppel?
I would argue that under 463, the court has the authority to do that. But estoppel certainly is the option. I mean, all the factors of estoppel, the detrimental reliance, and the Atkinson factors are all present. I mean, clearly there's a mutual recognition of a relationship between the child and the father. And Randy has willingly, more than willingly, taken on all the responsibilities, both emotionally and financially, to support this child.
Tell me, this is my concern. I mean, as I look at the statutory scheme, it is, hey, circuit court judge, don't order a blood test, because that then takes you on a whole new avenue. So say it's not in the best interest of the child to order a blood test. You know, find the husband, the father, and then you don't have to deal with the blood test establishing by clear and convincing evidence that let me use the name Brendan here, because is the father. And so that's the whole idea of this language. You know, don't get into that avenue, because if you get into that avenue and Brendan shows by 99.99% that he is the father, which constitutes under 89139 in this type of proceeding where you have the husband and someone else claiming parenthood, that it by clear and satisfactory evidence he's shown that, then what do you do? If someone has met the burden of proof in a paternity action, now presumption is just something, as I see it, is just something that is a tool that helps you meet the burden of proof. A presumption is something different conceptually than meeting the burden of proof. So under 89139, the language is constitutes a clear and satisfactory preponderance of the evidence. And so he's met the burden of proof. So now what do you do that he's met the burden of proof? We're beyond presumption. We're talking about meeting the burden of proof. How do you undo that? Because you opened the gate up, you know, God forbid that you did that. You shouldn't. But now that the gate's been opened, how do you undo someone who has met the burden of evidence of establishing fatherhood?
Well, I think that if purely the biological donation of DNA would raise to the level of someone being entitled to all the rights of fatherhood, I think that would strip this court of the authority to determine best interest. Now, answering specifically your question about what to do next is what the Court of Appeals did if we reached that point in time, which is to say the marital presumption was overcome.
And we're not talking about presumptions here. Now we're talking about he has met the burden of proof. That's something different than a presumption.
He's met his burden of proof scientifically, okay, but I don't believe that reads the intent of the understanding to rebut the presumption isn't merely on evidence of paternity in terms of biological testing or not. I think it does reach to the best interest determination, and that's where the Court of Appeals then kicked in to the equitable estoppel consideration, because once 767.481M was triggered after the first presumption was overcome and he's clearly the father, I think it creates the second rebuttable presumption that can be overcome, which under equitable estoppel grounds was overcome by Randy.
It seems to me that when you blend this and make presumption the same, you have to make presumption the same under the statute as meeting the burden of proof. But if they are not the same, then once you've established that you have met the burden of proof to establish that you are the father, why isn't undoing that, why doesn't that tie in to, and that you should have the rights of the father, I guess I'm adding that. It just seems to me that this is a termination of parental rights case, and that care if you can do that, but if you're going to terminate someone's parental rights after they have met the burden of proof, not presumption, met the burden of proof that they are the father, then there are statutorily and constitutionally certain things that a person is entitled to that perhaps Brendan didn't get here. You know, in a termination of parental rights, it's a very different sort of procedure, and there are very different safeguards in that kind of procedure than we have here. Seems to me that this is back-ending that procedure. Once you've opened the gate of allowing the test, you wouldn't have these problems if you didn't do the test, but once you've done that and he's proven, regardless of any presumptions, he's proven he's the father, then how do you undo that? Isn't that a termination of parental rights? Tell me.
Well, obviously
you don't think so, but tell me why.
I disagree. But, you know, I think that it's not termination of parental rights because we don't have to find the unfitness standard that is in protection in the termination of parental rights.
Why shouldn't you have to find? If he's the father, if he's proven to the requisite legal standard that he's the father, why shouldn't you have to show unfitness?
Because I think that when the court has the opportunity and the obligation to make the best interest determination, that best interest is far distinct from unfitness, because it doesn't allow the court to evaluate. And one of the things that came up in the other side's argument was the lack of interest in comparing parents.
Doesn't the best interest come in where whether or not to enter, just do that testing initially? Isn't that where the language comes into our discussion?
I think that's one part of it. Under 458, that statute does talk about best interest. But the fact that the legislature enacted 463, which now gives the trial courts another crack at best interest determination, underscores the importance of the court not having that power taken away from them.
Well, 463, again, is, let me get these numbers right. 463, does the best interest deal with whether or not to order the test? Where is that language?
No, it details with the best interest in terms of whether to dismiss the action, and that's the critical reading of 463, is that there's two options available to the circuit court under 463. One is to refuse to order genetic tests if they have not been taken, and, which means another option that the court can exercise, is to dismiss the action. Yep.
And that's the disputed, if you will, interpretation of that section. The Court of Appeals disputes that.
That's correct.
Are saying that you read the phrase dismiss that a judicial determination of whether you're reading the best interest of the child there only as it pertains to what you would say is the second option, the second and independent option the court has, that is to dismiss the action, and you would then, in your reading, best interest of the child would have nothing to do with whether or not they order tests, because you put that second phrase independent of the first phrase rather than conjoined with it.
I agree, and when I was discussing that matter in response to Justice Crooks's question, I believe that if you look at the structure of 463, when after the word may, which gives the court the option, it gives two actions the court can take and then describes following them what the conditions are to take that action.
Yeah. You would define under 463 that best interest is irrelevant to ordering tests, right?
Absolutely. Because
under sub 1M, best interest only applies to whether or not you order tests.
How do you reconcile that, in
sub 1M, best interest only applies to the issue of whether or not you allow blood tests to begin with, and under 463, it is irrelevant to your interpretation. Makes it irrelevant to whether or not you order blood tests to begin with.
And my guess is that's what the legislature felt at the time, too, is that that was too crippling in terms of the ability of the circuit court to make that analysis, that 458, dealing with first appearance, and we've discussed that before, at the time which 458 was enacted, was when the general best interest statute in paternity was removed effectively from the statutes. So they enacted 458-1M, which limited the court's best interest at that time to whether or not to order genetic tests, but feeling that it wasn't sufficient, for what other reason would they have added 10 years later 463?
And make best interest as to the taking of the test totally irrelevant.
Exactly. Now, with regard to the equitable estoppel argument, while we focus our brief on the fact that 463 should be determinant of this result in affirming the mandate of the Court of Appeals, I believe that the case law in Wisconsin since 1987 has recognized the equitable estoppel and equitable parenting doctrine, starting with DLH, where the Atkinson factors from the Michigan Court of Appeals case were enacted and adopted to be able to evaluate whether the sufficient bond has been has occurred between the parent and the child. And I think that's a key factor, because not only do we have a situation under Atkinson where there is a parental bond between the parent and child that's recognized, and that's included all over the record, including Dr. Crandall's psychological evaluation, most notably the observation that she had of Brendan and the child, where the child was uncontrollably screaming, needed to be comforted, and wanted her daddy, who was Randy. But in addition, Norma fostered this relationship by carrying on this relationship, never letting Randy know until essentially the day that she went into prison. They lived together as a family. They Randy provided all the financial support, and to this day, Randy provides the lion's share of support and comfort to this child. So I
has the counsel, if I could interrupt, has the equitable parent doctrine ever anywhere in the country been recognized as defeating biological paternity?
I can tell you that in reviewing the cases from around the country, to be honest, most of the states that have taken up equitable parenting in the context of the Atkinson case have not been willing to go that far, because they found authority essentially to do the same thing based upon other the statutes that they had. Now, there are cases that have dealt with equitable estoppel per se, but in terms of when the courts have been faced with do we adopt the Atkinson factors, it's been largely dismissed because there have been some other options. I think that a lot of those decisions are results-oriented, and I think if we look at the results that were reached in those cases, I think the courts were comforted by the fact that their statutory makeup gave them the ability to do the same thing and reach the same result that they could have had the equitable parenting Atkinson doctrine been adopted.
So it's my understanding that this is the first case ever in which the equitable parent doctrine has been used to defeat biological paternity. We're not talking about to establish equal
right.
footing for visitation purposes,
right.
anything like that.
Michigan, which developed the Atkinson case, continues to apply the doctrine. They continue to use that.
To defeat someone's asserted biological paternity, or to simply enter into a finding of equitable parenthood where there is no biological parent asserting parenthood in contravention of that?
I believe both. I think the York versus Murawski case was along similar circumstances. I'm not exactly positive on that, but I know that they continue to apply that doctrine. Other states haven't, and so no, this is relatively unique. But just because several states have disregarded it doesn't, I don't think, is extraordinarily persuasive in terms of what this court chooses to do in continuing to uphold what's in the best interest of the children.
The Court of Appeals decision here, and the trial court's order for that matter, preclude Brendan from ever asserting his rental rights, correct? He cannot assert any legal parental rights.
Not as a parent, but certainly the option is open, and it's still under review next year in terms of whether it's reasonable for him to have any placement rights with the child.
Pursuant to what sort of standing? If he has no standing as a parent because he has been precluded legally from being declared this child's parent despite the biology of the matter, what standing does he have to assert any rights whatsoever?
If I was arguing on their behalf, I think I'd argue that under 245 they've got the ability to do that, and if not, then this court's decision in HSHK.
245 is visitation rights of certain persons, which includes grandparent. He's not that.
Right.
Great-grandparent.
Right.
Step-parent. No. He's not married to Norma.
Not yet. Not at this time, no.
may never be.
Well, no, but I mean that certainly was the rationale that we heard explained for the fact why this relationship, you know, was kept under wraps. This future marriage and those relationships, he may have the ability to, would have the ability certainly under the step parent scenario. But I think that even if his standing to be able to have placement with the child is not found in the statutes, I think this court's decision in HSHK, I think, may give him the entree to do that. And I think this court did recognize the need to have equitable relief outside of the statutory guidelines to be able to afford people who do have the relationship and under the right circumstance to be able to have standing to do so.
The court has made factual findings that he does not have such a relationship with this child.
I think at the time of the circuit court entered this decision, I believe that the record was pretty clear that they did not have the same bond, certainly as Randy did with the child.
And by virtue of the Court of Appeals decision here, as well as the trial court order, he's precluded from ever establishing such a relationship.
I don't know that necessarily.
So the factual underpinnings necessary for standing under 245 are not here and can never be present.
They certainly could be present if the parties married. And like I said, I think under HSHK also, I think there's the ability to do that as well, because he did have a relation. There's no question he did have a relationship with the child. The 15 months between the birth of the child and Norma's incarceration, he had a significant amount of contact with the child. Now, when the court evaluated the psychological evaluations and made its findings with respect to the bond between the parents and the child, I think that the consideration at the time was in evaluating a comparison, more or less, in terms of who had the greater relationship with the child.
Counselor, I have one last question. If we were to conclude that 891.391A is the legislature's determination that Randy has shown by clear and convincing evidence that he's met his burden of proof as the father, and with all of our cases saying paternity is statutory, how do we have the authority to apply an equitable doctrine to overturn a statute that speaks to the same circumstances?
Well, I think some of the case law does indicate, Ulrich and other cases, that it is statutory. But I think that when we look, and I'll refer again to HSHK, was an opportunity where the court did not find the statute in terms of the context of the 767 to apply the rights to be able to exercise placement, and found a way to make that happen because that was in the best interest of the child. I think that the marital presumption issue only leads to yet another rebuttable presumption back, which can be found in the 767-48-1M, which then triggers the best interest determination and equitable estoppel considerations.
But don't you agree that we would have to, in some manner, to apply the equitable parent doctrine, conclude that the legislature hasn't spoken to the question you're presenting to us?
I would agree that you'd have to agree with the Court of Appeals findings that 891 overcoming presumption then only leads into the 767-48-1M determination.
Thank you, Mr. Weber. Before I conclude the argument in this case, it's my understanding that the students from Boscobel will be staying now and to have a session with one of the justices. Is that correct? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. You will or will not? Will not be able to spend time with a justice right now. Okay, thank you. Now there is another group, homeschool group. Are they present? They're outside. They do want to spend time with the justice. Okay. Now that I've clarified that, which has nothing to do with this case about children and equitable parents, but only about young people in the courtroom, the Boscobel students may leave, of course, if they wish to. Justice Wilcox will come back after we terminate and will visit with the Boscobel home children and anyone else in the courtroom who wishes to attend, because in keeping with our usual practice, a justice meets with the groups
after the second case is concluded and discusses the procedures that the court uses, not the substance of the case. Everyone is welcome to come, including counsel and anyone else in the audience. So that's the procedure as to Justice Wilcox. As to 02-0469, I'm sorry, did I cut off Ms. Weber in rebuttal? Now that I've been so busy taking care of our extracurricular activities, I'll go back to the case before I terminate it. Thank you, Ms. Weber. You may proceed with rebuttal. You've been very patient and courteous.
If you didn't want to hear from me again, you could have said so.
I wouldn't ever say that, Ms. Weber, but I only want to hear from you for about 5 minutes.
Thank you. This, to sum this case up, it comes under what essentially Randy is attempting to do is to pull out of the stipulation that he made in the trial court level that genetic testing was in this child's best interest. I believe he has to live with his agreement, and he has to live with the results that came out of that agreement. We are not here today to relitigate the definition of 767.458.1M or 767.463. Those issues were decided by the Court of Appeals, and what Randy is attempting to do through his counsel is to require reversing, essentially, of the Court of Appeals ruling on 767-463, which we're not here on today, and I believe that both the statutes, the appellate statutes, as well as the case law, does not allow this court to reverse a Court of Appeals decision when a cross appeal has not been taken. But more importantly, paternity was raised immediately upon Norma's incarceration in May of 1999. My client raised it in Illinois. Then Norma raised it in the divorce proceedings prior in, I believe, in December of 1999. She raised it as well to bring it into the divorce proceedings. As the record was crystal clear, my client appeared at all of the conferences, court appearances, everything regarding the divorce case except for the initial appearance, and I believe, or the temporary hearing date. And that is where the restraining order went into effect, barring him from having any contact with the child. But I believe that what counsel has said here today is that there is no dispute. There was a substantial relationship that my client forged with that child in the first 15 months. He was cut off, and he has not to this day been allowed to come back in to revisit the issue to somewhat establish the relationship. So in response to, I believe it was Justice Sykes' colloquy with Attorney Price, he's never going to be able to come in and get that kind of visitation. He is going to be cut out. And if his relationship with Norma fails, and it hasn't, but we cannot predict the future, he will forever be barred from having a relationship with his child. And the courts, particularly in Wisconsin, have never taken the doctrine in Atkinson, although it has been discussed in several cases, has never taken Atkinson, Michigan law, and stepping it up to granting that person legal parenthood. It limits it to visitation. It doesn't take it to the next level. And even, I believe, the court in DLJ, I believe it was, said we are not going to elevate the husband to the paternity, the legal fatherhood. We're going to keep it at third-party status. So absolutely, in this case, Randy absolutely meets the requirements under 767-245. We have conceded those, that he is third-party eligible for visitation, and we're willing to give him that. Everybody is willing to give him that. But what is not happening is that my client wants the ministerial duty after the genetic test, after he's met his burden of the adjudication of paternity in this case.
Also, what is the legislative purpose, do you think, on the face of the statute in allowing a best interest determination to be made prior to the taking of genetic tests but not after?
I believe that what it was for, particularly in longstanding marriages, where then when a divorce action comes up and the wife raises a paternity issue, or I'm sorry, the husband raises a paternity issue and wants to get out of paying support, and there is either an unknown biological father or the biological father wants nothing to do with the child. And I believe that in all the cases in which this court and the Court of Appeals throughout the state have applied Atkinson is where the biological father either was unknown or did not want anything to do with that child. So I believe that the legislature's intent was to provide the courts, the circuit courts, with never getting to the issue of who the biological parent was, essentially cutting everybody off and saying, we're not going to know this, we're not going to take the genetic test, and the best interest hearing should be applied prior to the genetic test being taken. And I don't think that there was any legislative intent, and I believe that the case law backs that up, that best interest hearings should not be held after genetic tests have been taken. And I believe that the statutes are clear on that, is that if you're gonna make it, you have to do it ahead of time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Could I ask?
Justice Presser.
Did the child have any voice in whether genetic testing was going to be permitted?
Yes, it did. The I believe throughout the course of the action dating back to September, I want to say of the beginning of the divorce in September of 99, Randy had opposed genetic testing throughout the course of the proceedings. And then for some reason unknown, the parties put the stipulation on the record in, I believe, September of 2000, all parties agreeing, including the guardian ad litem, to the genetic testing.
Well, okay. The guardian ad litem agreed.
Absolutely. So I believe that at that point, the best interests of the child were represented, and the court accepted it as in the child's best interest. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Weber. Have I neglected to call on anyone else? If not, that does conclude the hearing on 02-0469, Randy A.J. versus Norma I.J. and Brenda B. Thank you for presenting this very interesting case of first impression in this state, and we appreciate that. The students who want to leave may leave, as well as everyone else who wants to leave, and we'll make room for the homeschool children. Justice Wilcox will be out shortly.